Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are now known as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Mark Dunley. Today, on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with the discussion with Jack McGuy of Troy about Extinction Rebellion's upcoming climate protests in New York City on September 17th. Then we talk with Lindsay Kashgarian of the National Priorities Project about Saturday's Qatari Peace Conference. We're then joined by the Civil Liberties Union to talk about the aggressive campaign of the Saratoga Springs Police Department against Black Lives Matters protesters. After that, as part of our Election Watch 2021 with Corinne Carey, we hear from Frank Merola seeking re-election as Rensselaer County Clerk, and we end up with Youth FX talking to us about their Arts to Work Fellowship for Digital Media Artists. But first, here are headlines.
The Times Union reports that 1 million New Yorkers, or about 14% of the population, still have no broadband internet. 36% of low-income residents lack access to the broadband internet.
JCOPE, the state's ethics commission, has again asked the state attorney general to launch a criminal investigation into the 2019 leak of confidential information to Governor Cuomo. The AG recently said that the previous vote requesting an investigation did not meet the threshold under JCOPE's complex decision-making rules, since the governor's appointees had not voted for the referral. The matter centers on a JCOPE meeting in January 2019, when the commission apparently voted in private against pursuing an investigation of Joseph Percoco, the former campaign manager to Governor Cuomo, who is accused of misusing government resources to work on the government reelection campaign. Cuomo called Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie right after the meeting to complain about the way Hastie's appointee had voted on the matter.
A federal judge in Utica issued an order Tuesday that will temporarily restrain employers from enforcing a state vaccine mandate on healthcare workers who have sought a religious exemption from receiving the shots. However, virtually no religion has a position against vaccines.
Masks will now be required in all childcare and daycare centers in New York, Governor Kathy Hochul announced Wednesday. Face coverings also will need to be worn at state-regulated residential and congregate day programs.
The Times Union reports that the Capital Region is currently experiencing its highest daily caseloads of COVID-19 and hospitalizations since February, when the region was just 1 month out from the worst of its deadly winter surge. Fortunately, deaths from the disease are occurring at a much lower rate, and yet it's another sign that the coronavirus vaccines are working to prevent death.
The vice president and one of New York's largest labor unions told the state Senate committee on Tuesday that years of staffing and budget cuts at the state office for people with developmental disabilities have created critical shortfalls in the ability to provide quality and accessible services for at-risk New Yorkers. The union blamed the staffing cuts on the effort by former Governor Cuomo to limit annual state spending increases to 2%. That's it for the headlines.
And first up, Extinction Rebellion is holding a climate protest on September 17th in New York City to say enough is enough. Mark talked with Jack, my guy, of Troy about his participating in the event.
We're talking today with Jack McGuy, a resident of Troy, who's going to be joining Extinction Rebellion down in New York City on Friday, September 17th. Enough is enough. He's been with Extinction Rebellion both locally and in New York City for prior protests. So, Jack, why are people gathering in New York City on September 17th?
Well, hi, Mark. Thanks for inviting me. We are continuing to protest the slow pace of governmental action on climate change. I've been doing this for a couple of years, which was already pretty belated because it really should have started, 30 years ago. It's just to continue to push things to move faster than they are moving, because the sooner we make the incredible sacrifices that are going to need to be made, the less suffering will happen and probably the cheaper it will be as well.
Now, looking at some of the promotional material from XR for this particular event, they actually, focus on COP26, which is supposed to be the international climate gathering that's supposed to take place in Glasgow, though with COVID, that's still up in the air, taking place in Glasgow in November. So it seems a little bit not just focused on New York City, but really demanding worldwide action on climate.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that, it's a worldwide problem. So that's very appropriate. One of the reasons why New York is such a salient place to protest is that, the UN is there and they are meeting this week. The General Assembly is meeting this month there prior to the COP26, which stands for Conference of the Parties. That just means, as many nations as are able to make it. So prior to the COP26 in November, there's a UN General Assembly meeting this month. And I believe that that's the reason why we're having this protest now, and why we're having it in New York.
Now, Extinction Rebellion tends to focus a little bit more on demand for much quicker action. And they do talk about the need for citizens' assemblies rather than sort of like specific demand, say, the $3.5 trillion green infrastructure package that the Senate and Congress is supposed to vote upon.
Right.
But are there any, specific, actions that XR is really hoping to see, be adopted in the near future?
Well, I've been involved, somewhat over the past couple of years, I can't say I can represent the inner workings or thinkings of people who are very involved with Extinction Rebellion. I think what you're saying is very true, and it's rather important that XR has, on purpose, a non-legislative agenda. They're not trying to promote any particular bit of legislation or method for achieving the goals. It's really just a single issue protest group just to raise awareness. And it's not, for that reason, it's not exclusive to, it's not something that I feel like I can do exclusively. Like, I also need to be involved with my local politics and my state politics in order to push through legislation that relates to these things. I just think that XR has a particular strength in the simplicity of its message. And that message, involves very quickly, the demand to very quickly reduce greenhouse gas emissions worldwide.
And I should probably disclose to the listeners that I've also been active with Extinction Rebellion and got arrested at one of their actions down on Wall Street a couple of years ago. But I believe you might have been part of the group that got arrested the next day down there, maybe for parking a boat in the middle of Times Square or something. But what is sort of attracted to you of XR, and what are some of your experiences been so far?
Well, I was, I got involved with it up here in Troy. There were a number of people who, when we found out about it, started to meet, and eventually we connected with a much larger group in New York and joined their protests. So I've been arrested down in New York twice, in April of 2019 and again in October of 2019, when there was this bright green boat parked on Broadway and I think 33rd or so, Times Square. And I glued my hand to the side of the boat, just basically so that we could get a lot of good media attention for the issue so that we were there long enough so that we could get, you know, a lot of good media coverage of that. That was really the reason for doing such a, you know, being so troublesome is to get the, be able to get enough attention to the issue.
So, you know, what can listeners do to help, you know, support Extinction Rebellion at this point?
Well, at this point, people could go to xrebellion.nyc and find out more about the protests, which is happening this Friday, the 17th of September in Midtown, New York, and sign up. There's a way to actually just like express your interest and say that you're interested in coming down. And there are a lot of different roles that can be taken from just, you know, holding a sign at the periphery, jail support, meaning that those helping out those people like myself who are likely to end up briefly in jail, and things in between. So, you know, there's a lot of room for help. And so if this, you know, for those people for whom this sounds like a, you know, a worthy cause, check it out and consider coming down. I know it's short notice, but also there will be, I'm sure there'll be things in the future. So keep an eye out by signing up with them.
A lot of climate groups, a lot of activist groups, of course, have been hampered, you know, by the COVID crisis and the need for social distancing. Probably XR more than, say, other climate groups, since XR, you know, focuses so heavily on, you know, actions out in the street and public gatherings and in many cases doing civil disobedience if people are inclined. How is the Capital District XR functioning these days? Rumors are they're going to try to have a reboot sometime in the near future?
I'm sorry, you're asking the wrong person.
You know, what would you say to some of our political leaders right now about what do they need to do to step up to really, you know, make climate action real? Because obviously, you know, especially the Democrats these days, Republicans tend to be climate deniers, but they, you know, the Democrats, you know, generally admit that climate is a serious problem, but they don't seem to be moving fast enough or treating it like a real climate emergency.
That's true. And that's really, I mean, I don't feel like I'm very intelligent as a political animal, but so it's a very simple act for me as somebody who isn't particularly wonky on politics to, you know, just simply put my body on the line and make it known that, you know, somebody like me who has a good amount of privilege in the world, you know, that I'm willing to put it on the line. And I hope that the politicians, the people who represent me will help them to understand that, you know, that it's important. But I'm sorry, I don't really have a clear, you know, idea for an agenda or something like that. So in a way, what I was saying earlier about XR is particularly appropriate to somebody like me who doesn't really, isn't particularly wonky about politics.
And in the last 45 seconds, some of your more mainstream friends, assuming you have some, you know, how do they react to, you know, sort of your civil disobedience, and how do you explain to them, well, this is what motivates me to do this at this point in the world?
It's a great question. You know, it comes up both in my family and with some of my friends who are rather more conservative than me. And I don't think, I think it's a matter of just kind of letting it sink in with them. You know, things are so polarized at this point in our society that somebody who's more on the right side of, not the correct side, but the right side of the spectrum, knowing, you know, and being friendly with somebody who's willing to take such actions, I think is a really great way to just sort of allow them to start thinking differently. And so that's, I think that's really important.
Well, we're out of time. We're talking with Jack McGuy. September 17th, we'll probably do a follow-up report, Extinction Rebellion, New York City, doing Enough is Enough. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. So Jack's day job is as an arborist. So he actually was one of the guys climbing the tree next to my house this week to help with the antenna for one of the Media Sanctuary radio stations. And we will be following up after September 17th, and also in Troy next Friday, Fridays for a Future, the young student types on September 24th.
Next up, the 23rd annual Qatari peace conference is being held this week, focusing on climate and the military. Here, Mark talks with Lindsay Koshegian of the National Priorities Project.
For this week's Peace Bucket, we're joined by Lindsay Koshegian, who's with the National Priorities Project. And she, I believe, actually is the keynote speaker at this Saturday's 23rd Annual Qatari Peace Conference, talking about militarism, climate change, and the existential threats we face. We've had Lindsay and others on from the National Priorities Project in the past, but Lindsay, why don't you just give us a brief intro to the National Priorities Project, and then, you know, maybe give us a little intro to your talk this weekend.
Sure, Mark. Thanks for having me. National Priorities Project has been around since 1983, actually, when it was formed by a few friends in Springfield, Massachusetts, who noticed that a lot of locally run programs and libraries and things were having to cut programming. And when they went to look to find out why, they found the answer in Ronald Reagan's federal budget and in the buildup of military spending. And at the time, it was also a drastic cut in social spending. And so ever since then, the National Priorities Project has watched the federal budget and kept an eye on how much we've spent on the military and war and how much we've spent on human needs and social programs. And we're at a really critical time for this right now. We are facing a climate crisis that is just building and gaining in urgency, and we are far from taking the steps that we need to take to address it. You know, we're trying desperately as a society, as a world, to emerge from this global pandemic that has shaped our lives, all of our lives, for the last year and a half. And we're really struggling economically at the same time. You know, we have millions of people who are facing homelessness because of the pandemic when eviction moratoriums end. We have a labor market that can't seem to provide enough living wage jobs for people, and corporations that are just able to kind of keep getting away with the same types of tax evasion and sub-living wage jobs and all of these things. And in the same time, we're just pouring billions and billions of dollars every year into the Pentagon and war, and increasingly into militarizing at home, you know, increasingly into the militarization of the southern border and our immigration enforcement systems and mass incarceration, and all of these things that just try to, you know, try to solve all of our problems through militarism and violence, and really at the expense of real solutions to problems like climate change and the pandemic and making sure that everybody is able to live in this country.
I was reading briefly one of the reports your group had issued a while back, and you made the point that racism and racial oppression form the foundation for both the extractive fossil fuel economy and the militarized economy, which is certainly true, but not a point that many people make. And, you know, could you explain that a little bit more?
Yes. So, you know, both of these things, there are a few things in common here. You know, one is that the fossil fuel industry and the military industrial complex both kind of have their fingers in our government and are able to pull out a lot of strings and make sure that they continue to get their needs met. They're both obviously tremendously profit-driven and things that don't particularly contribute to the well-being of ordinary people, but make tremendous amounts of profit for a few select people and their shareholders. And they're very destructive industries. You know, fossil fuel, in the most obvious ways, it's the direct cause of climate change. But the military-industrial complex is the Pentagon. The U.S. Pentagon is the largest industrial fossil fuel emitter, the largest single entity that emits fossil fuels in the world, emits more than any other single entity in the world. It emits more than many countries. Our Pentagon and our wars emit more fossil fuel emissions every year than many mid-sized countries. And so both of them are tremendously contributing directly to climate change as well. Of course, another thing that they both have in common is that both of them are seen as job creators by too many of our members of Congress, to some degree by the public, although the public is much less of the opinion that these are major job creators than members of Congress are. But that's one of the reasons that they've both been so hard to take apart, is the perception that they're job creators. But the truth is that they are not good job creators compared to things that we might want, like renewable energy or higher education or public education or healthcare or other things that we ought to be investing more in, and that we haven't invested in because in large part we're investing so much in these destructive industries.
You addressed this issue earlier, but you had mentioned prior to us getting on that your organization, as part of the observance of the 20th anniversary of 9/11, put out a report about how much money, basically we have lost to domestic needs to, fund this so-called war on terror. You know, what were some of the key findings from that report?
Yes, Mark. Well, it's been 20 years since 9/11 and 20 years since the U.S. started the war in Afghanistan. And of course, the U.S. has just very short time ago pulled our last troops from Afghanistan. But in those 20 years, we have just poured trillions of dollars into our war machine and the Pentagon. And as I mentioned earlier, the increasing militarization here at home. And our new report finds that we've spent $21 trillion on these things over the past 20 years. And just to put that into a bit of context, most of us don't really have a good reference point for trillions in our day-to-day lives. It's a little bit of a hard number to understand. But whereas we've spent $21 trillion on militarization and war over the past 20 years, it would have cost just $4.5 trillion to fully build a new electric grid for this country based on renewable sources for the entire country. And that's less than a quarter of what we've spent on militarism during that time.
Now, I also read in one of your statements, one of the, great threats from climate change in terms of military conflict, will be the issue of, refugees, fleeing as the, land is lost, water is lost, food is lost. You've mentioned that the Pentagon has been preparing a militarized armed lifeboat response to climate chaos. What did you mean by that?
The Pentagon has actually been preparing for climate change for a long time. So even going back into the 90s and the early 2000s, many of us knew about climate change. We'd heard of it. Maybe we'd heard Al Gore talking about it, or some of the scientists that were warning about it, going back that far. But the Pentagon has been taking climate change seriously for that long as well. The problem is that the Pentagon's approach hasn't been to say that we need to prevent climate change, or that we need to turn the process of climate change around, or even that we need to be resilient in this country to climate change. The Pentagon's entire approach, of course, because it is what it is, has been a military approach. And so you have the Pentagon saying that we need to, prepare to essentially rebuff refugees from climate nations, or that we need to essentially build up our military response so that when climate-driven conflict emerges in places around the world, the U.S. military is ready to engage in or put down that conflict militarily. And so it's tremendously damaging. It's hard to imagine a more dystopian response to climate refugees than for the U.S. military to go in and occupy a space and invade and do all of the things that they do. And the Pentagon, as I mentioned, has been talking about this for decades. And they're still kind of taking that approach that instead of addressing the root issues, they're interested in building up military bases around U.S. military bases to be resilient to climate change. let alone what happens to the people who live in the areas around those bases. So it's a tremendously dystopian response to climate change that the Pentagon has had for a long time and that they're continuing today.
I did like one thing I saw. You're right. Immigrant justice is climate justice, and challenging militarism is critical to achieving both. And we've been talking with Lindsay Gashgarian, who'll be one of the keynote speakers at the 23rd annual Qatari Peace Conference this Saturday, September 18th. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. So Lindsay was with the National Priorities Project to find out and to register for the Qatari Peace Conference. Just go to QatariPeaceConference.org, K-A-T-E-R-I, PeaceConference.org. And the theme this year is Code Red Planet, Climate Change, Militarism, and Nuclear Weapons.
And for those of you just tuning in, I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Mark Dunley. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany. This program comes from the beautiful Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are now known as the Stockbridge Munsee community.
And next up, the New York Civil Liberties Union recently tweeted that Saratoga Police Department's aggressive fear campaign must stop. Melanie Timble, regional director of the NYCLU Capital Region Office, spoke with Elizabeth Press about the arrests that continue to be made by the Saratoga Police Department.
Today, we're joined by Melanie Timble, regional director of the NYCLU Capital Region Office. She's here to talk about what's been happening in Saratoga Springs with the arrests of activists. I think the total number we're up to is 10 arrests stemming from this July protest. Melanie Timble, of course, welcome back to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Can you talk about this idea that there are activists turning themselves in for a protest back in July? What's happening from your point of view at the NYCLU in terms of activism, protests, and free speech in Saratoga Springs?
Well, we're the NYCLU, of course, is seriously concerned about the overhanded and very aggressive police maneuver that happens 2 months or 2 to 3 months after an incident occurred. It seems very staged to us, and a situation in which the police are clearly trying to discourage free speech and to frighten people from expressing themselves in Saratoga. And this is a city that's vibrant and has a lot going on. And it's of really extreme concern to us that the police department has decided to inhibit people from expressing themselves and make themselves into more or less a racist organization in enforcing only protest laws against Black Lives Matter. The earlier comments by the assistant chief of police, Catone, his threats of arrest and claiming that if you're not with us, you're against us, is very concerning. And for him to actually follow through with arrests to intimidate people goes that much further to express the fact that the police department is going to come down very hard on people who disagree with them. And that's not what America is all about. The police should not be trying to silence people. They should be listening and responding to the community. And it's very disappointing that the police department continues to pit itself against a particular group rather than negotiating and, you know, trying to understand the issues that are involved here and mediate the situation rather than escalate it.
Thanks, Melanie. And actually, can you just tell us about the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution regarding this idea of being able to demonstrate or peacefully assemble? What does that say?
Well, yes, you are allowed to peacefully assemble in public space and make your point known without any governmental interference. As a matter of fact, in most cases, we ask for assistance, free speech, and people who like to rally prefer that the police are on their side, protecting them from any kind of escalation. And as opposed to that, the Saratoga Police Department has decided that instead of assisting people who wish to get their voices heard out in the public, they've decided to inhibit that speech and actually in a lot of cases become antagonistic. And instead of de-escalating situations, to escalate them to the extent that people could get hurt, people could be interfered with in their daily lives, because the police department has decided that they'd rather fight against people who disagree with them rather than listening and understanding and reacting in a way that would be helpful to the situation.
Now, we're talking about a day, July 14th. So July 14th, there was a protest and action in Saratoga Springs, and police say that marchers were blocking Broadway near Congress Park that day. So How come we're seeing all these arrests now in September? And what type of charges are we seeing people get? And have you seen this type of thing before here in the Capital Region where months later warrants are out for people's arrests?
No, we have not seen this in the Capital Region. And normally, when people are obstructing traffic, which does happen because people who are protesting want to escalate their situation to get on the news or have people wake up and pay attention. And at those moments, usually the police do step in and make some arrests to remove people from obstructing the traffic or interfering with the flow of sidewalk traffic. That's what normally happens. This time, the police allowed the protesters to obstruct traffic for a certain limited period of time. And then they asked that the protesters move back into the park, which they started to do. And then the police escalated the situation and it became rather contentious between people. But still, I think only two arrests were made that day. And then the police put it on hold. These warrants for the arrests were all made without notifying the people that were subjects of the warrants. They have since done so, but the warrants weren't issued until about 3 days before the arrests were made in front of the city council, which gives us a great concern about how strategic the department is being in making sure that the arrests were public, that they were embarrassing, that they were aggressive, and one in which other people that participated in the Black Lives Matter protests and other people that are sympathetic to the Black Lives Matter are really worried about coming out on the street and making their voices heard because they're intimidated by the police department. And those are things that we really are very concerned about here at the NYCLU. The police should always be helpful rather than antagonistic. Certainly, they need to protect the public, but these arrests did nothing to protect the public. Instead, they're making the public more afraid of the police. And that in the long run is going to prove detrimental to the police department because they will find that people in their community are not going to cooperate in any kind of investigation, are not going to be calling them when things are occurring because they feel like the police will overstep their boundaries and disrespect the public. I think they've already shown that they certainly disrespect Black Lives Matter and the individuals involved in that, in the way that they issued the warrants and then made the arrests in such a public and obnoxious way.
And the arrests are disorderly conduct, which is a violation, and another additional unlawful imprisonment charge, which is a misdemeanor. Yes. And so, you know.
Yeah, and we'll find out, you know, as these cases get adjudicated, how strong the evidence is that really, we question the quality of all of the arrests because we, you know, looked at some of this footage and some of the facts and certainly, you know, some of the charges may stand, but we are withholding any judgment against that. Our criticism is not for if people were breaking the law and the cases need to be dealt with. The problem is the way the police has staged the whole situation. First of all, to wait so long to issue the warrants, to make the initial arrests in front of the city hall in a gathering that was peaceful and people had intended to go into city council meeting, and the police were very disruptive and very public in the way that they did this, which only publicly reflects to us that the police department is aggressive and racist, basically.
Now, each of these 10 people so far, maybe more, need representation for when they go to trial, like a lawyer. The NYCLU is not directly representing the people that have been arrested in Saratoga Springs, but how is the NYCLU acting as a resource, as a voice here in this situation?
Yeah, well, first of all, we wanted to make sure that everyone is represented, either through the public defender's office or through private attorneys. And we have been successful in that. And if there are any other outstanding warrants that we're not aware of, we hope that people will contact us if they need legal assistance, because we will certainly look through our network and try and provide them with criminal attorneys that will assist them. In addition, we are talking to as many attorneys that are willing to speak with us, because we do have expertise on First Amendment enforcement and so on in dealing with police departments that have overstepped their authority. We hope that people in the future will feel comfortable in expressing themselves, knowing that there's a network out there that can protect them from over-policing. We wish, of course, that the police department would realize how far they've overstepped and how frightened their community is, because it will cause an incredible backlash as they try and solve crime's future.
And as we wrap up this interview, Melanie Trimble, is there anything I didn't ask you about Saratoga Springs that you want to make sure that we cover here today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine?
You know, we're hoping that the police department will come and sit at a table, or at least recognize that they have overstepped. Certainly, as we see these cases go to the courts, we will know better where the law stands and how well protected people can be in Saratoga as they move forward with expressing themselves.
Great. Thanks again for joining us. Melanie Trimble from the New York Civil Liberties Union here in the Capital Region. Thanks for joining us on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thanks very much.
So, I mean, Saratoga Springs is always considered sort of the liberal community and otherwise very conservative Saratoga Republican-dominated county. So I think people are very surprised about how aggressive and overreactive the police department has been about going after Black Lives Matter protesters, and also the failure of the local politicians to speak out. And I know that in some other issues that I work with, we have people telling us, oh, they won't go up to protest now in Saratoga Springs because they're concerned about being arrested by the local police, and they want to be available to do other protests. So we will continue to follow this issue.
Next up, Frank J. Marola is seeking a fourth term as Rensselaer County Clerk. Corinne Carey spoke with Frank for Election Watch 2021 about the role of the county clerk and his view of the office.
Frank, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Can I call you Frank, or is there some kind of an honorific with the county clerk position?
Oh, that's perfect. Frank is perfect.
Okay, great. So you have been county clerk in Rensselaer for quite a long time.
I have.
I think a lot of people don't know what a county clerk does, and I figured you'd be the best person to describe it. Can you tell our listeners what the county clerk does?
Sure. The county clerk is responsible for all the land records for the county, such as deeds, mortgages, judgments, maps, court filings. We have military discharges. We do notaries. We do passports, pistol permits. We record divorces. And in addition to that, some county clerks in New York State have DMV services. There are 62 counties in New York State. 51 county clerks also have DMV services. As a matter of fact, I started as the deputy county clerk. I was there for 11 years, and I worked at the DMV as the deputy.
What's the most important issue you think you face as the county clerk?
And responsibility for all the land records, we create history every single day. I mean, when you look at the records that we have here, we had it from the beginning of the county's start right up until today. And every day we create more history and more history. So it's the responsibility to keep all those records, make them available to the public. And that's our big responsibility.
When the COVID-19 pandemic hit New York, I imagine that your office had to go through a number of changes to meet the needs of the residents of Rensselaer County. Can you talk about what you did to transition and how your administration fared?
Yeah, I think we did a fantastic job, whether it be with the county executive's approval or just the employees in our office. Everybody stepped up. People are still buying homes. They still need to record deeds. There's still proceedings for courts. Everything is still coming through our office. So it was a challenge, but we stepped up to the plate. We did a great job, and I commend all my employees. I thought we did a great job with it.
Did the adaptations that you had to make you think about how your office needs to modernize? Have you given any thought to modernizing the way that the county clerk operates?
Actually, we have. In the county clerk side, we're doing a lot of electronic stuff. We do electronic recordings, electronic filings. So some of that stuff, there's no longer the need for someone to stand at the counter to record a document. And that's, it's a big part, and it's an important part. As far as the DMV side, we made some major changes. And like I said, I was a deputy for 11 years. I think the DMV side, it was to our benefit. COVID really, we made some changes, and actually, I think it's the best it's ever been. We no longer allow the big crowd to come into the office. We have the social distancing spots. And if there's enough room, there's a spot, you can come in. If there's not, you're outside. You're no longer allowed to come in and crowd the office. So that we made some major changes, all for the benefit of our office and the benefit for the employees.
Are the changes that you've made, are you planning on continuing them beyond this public health emergency?
Most definitely. Most definitely. Like I said, I believe all the years I've been here, it seems to be the best it's ever been. And we made some great changes. The public is thrilled with it. We have had no backlash from the public. They like the idea of not allowing everybody into the office. You know, it used to be a family event, even for coming into the clerk's office, if you were coming in to bring, whether it be passports or whether it's coming in for a notary, pistol permits, people seem to bring their whole family with them like it's an event. And that same way is the DMV. Well, we no longer allow that. Now we allow, as you're coming in to do a transaction, you come in, everyone else has to stay out. So it really cut down on the amount of people coming into the office, and all for the benefit of us.
Are there services that are available online now that weren't before?
Well, there are. There are a lot of DMV services that are online now. You can do a duplicate title. You can renew a driver's license. You can do almost anything. You can take a permit test without coming in. So they made those services easier for the public. The public is really taking advantage of that now, big time.
You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and I'm speaking with Frank J. Marola, Rensselaer County Clerk. Mr. Marola has served in his role since 1998 and is seeking a fourth term in this role. Frank, what did you do before you became county clerk? You seem to really enjoy this work. Did you come from, I know you mentioned your DMV background, but what else in your background led you to this position?
I was a small business owner, actually only about four blocks from where I sit right now. I owned a little Italian deli. I owned a ice cream shop. I had an alarm system business. So I was a business person. And I think with the county clerks, and I think most of us, what it is, it's county clerks is really about customer service. And I think I learned that over the years, being a small business owner, that customer service is the most important thing. And I think that's what we built this office on. All the employees are customer service oriented. That's the biggest part. I always feel like you could teach someone to do anything, but you can't teach people how to be good at the counter and deal with the public. And I think that's our forte. That's what I've always run on. And that's why I think I've been very successful at it.
When you mentioned that more and more services are now available online, are you concerned about data privacy as more and more functions of local government go online?
There's so much out there. I'm not really concerned. I mean, the state's got a great system, and we have a great system here. Well, IQS is our vendor. They do a great job. They have the majority of county clerks doing business with them. And I think they do a great job with that. I'm not really concerned with it at all.
I'm curious about whether there are areas of discretion that a county clerk has and whether that discretion is ever exercised in a way that's motivated by a particular political perspective. Do you find that there is discretion in your job?
You know, what's unusual with a county clerk, like I said, it's just we're responsible for land records. We don't have any case where we go in and we vote for or against anything. It's a simple solution. You're coming in, you're recording a mortgage, or you're looking for a map. Everything there is cut and dry. So there's no Republican versus Democrat. We don't have any stance on that. It's very simple. And I think that's the part I actually enjoy. Although you have to be elected to be a county clerk, I also think there really is, once you're elected, I don't think there's anything that has anything to do with Republican versus Democrat, one party versus the other. We give good customer service to anyone that walks in through the office. There's no deed that says somebody's a Republican, or no deed that someone says they're a Democrat. It's just they record deeds and mortgages, pistol permits, and I like that part of it.
When you are not fulfilling your duties as the county clerk and when you're not out campaigning, what do you do for fun? Where can we find you relaxing in the area?
Well, you would find me relaxing. I have 8 grandchildren and another one on the way. And my biggest part is I love being with my family, local family, and that's the part I enjoy.
Where can we find your family
in the area? In the area, North Greenbush. I reside in North Greenbush. I was born and raised in Troy. And like I said, I had a business just a couple blocks from where I sit, which is in the Troy office. And but we live in North Greenbush for the last 30 or 35 years, which is not far from the city limits. We're all kind of local, so it's nice.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I feel like we need a really good Italian deli around here. So I'm sad I wasn't around when you owned your business, but I'm very glad to talk to you.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So Corinne is heading up our Election Watch 2021. You can find other interviews on mediasanctuary.org. And Mr. Merola will be facing off against Justin Foster on the Democratic line in November and Jason Cloud on the Working Families Party line.
And Youth FX is launching the first Arts to Work Fellowship in upstate New York, with a goal to help emerging artists of color secure substantial and sustainable career opportunities in the field of film and digital media production.
Hi, everybody. My name is Bound Suchak. I am the co-executive director at YouthFX, which is a media arts program based in Albany, New York.
So you are here to talk about the fellowship program that you're launching. This is called Arts to Work with the number 2. Can you tell us a little bit about what this fellowship is going to be about?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, this is a very exciting initiative that we are launching. Applications just opened. As you mentioned, it's called Arts to Work, and it's really a workforce development program that, kind of comes out of the reality that there's an incredible amount of talented young folks who are very well versed in digital media, who are really understand the skills and the necessary, talent and that goes into the work of creating digital media, but aren't necessarily folks who are college tracked or people that have had circumstances in their lives that have really cut off access to training and, higher levels of education in that field. So what this program really does is sort of allow folks from, marginalized and historically, sort of marginalized communities to be able to access high level training and learn the skills that it takes to actually become professionals in this field I have to say that this is really the brainchild of an incredible organization called the National Alliance for Media Arts and Culture, which is an organization that is a national leader in actually facilitating youth media, strategic growth in the field, innovation. And actually, you know, this program was something that was conceived of by their executive director, Wendy Levy, and it was something that her and I have been talking about for years with them and the possibility of this coming to upstate New York. And so the program is going to be starting in November. The applications are open now on our website. And it's going to be a 10-month fellowship that's going to include, you know, a lot of workshops, sort of classroom-based workshops and, you know, everything from as really simple as self-care and how to sort of like, you know, think about your sustainability, financial practices, like what kinds of ways that you can kind of professionalize your financing and invoicing and all that. Sort of like very kind of like, you know, granular stuff. But then it's going to also include, which is the most exciting to us, you know, the possibility for production, for young people to learn production, to get into different roles on sets, to actually create their own short films and work on short films that are being made by local filmmakers, but also our production team at Youth FX, which is called Rogue FX, and also giving them the opportunity then after that to actually be placed with a nonprofit or a small business to get a 2-month paid job placement opportunity. So the way that the program is really designed is to kind of scale from, you know, the classroom training to the production training on sets, on site, and then to actually go into the workplace and work in a position that will allow you the chance to show your skills. And hopefully, like the sort of, you know, the big goal is that these young folks who are going through the programs, and by young, we're the age that we're sort of identifying as 18 to 25 year olds, that they actually get offered a position, or that they're able to at that point build their reels and their resumes to the point where they're able to then pursue freelance work. Because as we know in this work, it's not just about like getting a sort of traditional, you know, 9-to-5 job or a job with a single place, but it's about learning how to be diversifying your skill set and be able to really market and pitch yourself to other people. And then I think for me, ultimately, like I'm really very excited about the possibility of kind of helping young folks to unlock the possibilities of storytelling in all the different forms, from documentary to podcasting to narrative films to episodic, so that there's this idea that yes, we're really training you to sort of be in the workforce in the creative arts, but we're also training you to be self-determined and to empower yourself as an artist to be able to understand the different, you know, varieties of opportunities that are out there and how you can position yourself best to be ready for those opportunities. The cool thing about this program is it's paid too. So this is another thing. It's a paid opportunity. Folks will be getting actually paid for the hours that they put in. They'll be paid on the work sites. They'll be paid for the production work. And it goes from November all the way till August of 2022. And then the cool thing about it is you're going to be tapped into a national network. Right now, there's Arts to Work sites in 5 cities across the country, including Dallas, Atlanta, Chicago, I believe, and Philadelphia. And then we will be the first upstate New York hub for Arts to Work. And eventually, the program aims to really sort of essentially disrupt the idea that you have to go to film school in order to make a career in digital media or film. Because we all know there's people who are doing this work and have zero higher ed in their sort of toolkit that they learned by themselves. They learned by watching videos. They learned by making films and by doing productions. And so we're hoping that this is something that really creates a path for sustainability and self-determination for young folks.
So many things of what you said are staying with me. I think just learning how to do invoices and these practical things are often left out of a lot of the training of at least creative and I assume all other educations. Sounds to me like a path to success of like you're getting not only the theoretical but the practical and then actually working for someone, because even if you learn all of that in a classroom, having to actually set yourself back and listening to a client and understanding the needs of delivering something that's asked of you, that you know, you still get to bring out your personality, but that in itself is very much of a skill set.
Yeah, I think that's really one of the things that we wanted to have be set apart, is that we really want to kind of try our best to draw from our own experiences as artists, as filmmakers, as folks who work with, you know, client-based productions as well as independent productions, to kind of give them the sense of the range of things that they might encounter and to essentially prepare them to be able to handle those things. And I think often, you know, the sort of professionalization of the work of being an artist is something that is not taught. And often it's something that actually make or break someone's long-term sustainability in this field. And, you know, whether it's like writing grants or understanding how to, you know, invoice and ask for what you're worth. I mean, those things are really, I think, very underrepresented in traditional, you know, four-year college film schools.
Like, why don't we have more fellowships that actually pay somebody to learn, but also just these all-encompassing learning opportunities? Why isn't this standard?
Well, you know, I mean, that's a whole nother conversation to me. I mean, I do think, like, you know, higher ed has sort of cornered this idea that you need to sort of have people in a very formalized setting, you know, and pay these exorbitant amounts of money to do this, get this type of training. But I think, you know, places like the Sanctuary for Independent Media, places like UPFX, places like, you know, DCTV in New York City, and, you know, there's so many of them across the country, are actually, you know, showing that you don't need that, you know. And I think the internet itself, like YouTube and Vimeo and these, you know, these sites where you can really create a community, create a page, and just really, you know, be, you know, kind of essentially valued or judged by the quality and the and of the work you're putting out, you know. And there's so many ways to self, you know, to self learn and work with others and build your skills. And I think part of it is just like getting away from this kind of mythology that so many people hang on to, that we need, you know, these institutionalized spaces to learn and give us that accreditation or that degree. Because I'll tell you, like, you know, most people, they don't, no one asks where your degree was from. They want to see your work. They want to see your reel. They want to, like, hear from someone that worked with you that you're someone that, you know, is capable and has the skills and has a good personality. You know, I think being able to talk to people and learning how to sort of present yourself is super important, you know. And I think for us on organizational side, just looking at all these funding opportunities, and we're saying, how do we pass these on to folks in our community in a way that not only just kind of provides them with the capacity to do the program and not have to decide if they have to take that second job or do a program that's going to help them build on a passion that they might have, that they can build that into a career, but also to place value on the program and to say, like, you know, you're actually going to be doing work. You're actually going to be producing things. And our goal is not to have it be these sort of projects that it's like, oh, let's just try and produce something just kind of for fun and try. I mean, obviously, you know, we want people to have some level of fun and enjoyment and joy in this process, but we want them to understand, like, that, you know, they're going to actually be creating work. And sometimes it's going to be client work. And again, when they do the job placement, you know, portion of it, it's really also saying to the business owners and the nonprofits that we have already engaged with about this process that, like, we're actually going to be bringing someone to the table that could potentially be someone that brings a lot of energy and a lot of skill to your organization and help you elevate the work that you're doing by amplifying it through the power of video.
How can interested participants apply for the fellowship? Where can they find more information?
Everything's online. It's at youthfx.org/arts-to-work. And as you said, it's arts with a number 2, work. The deadline to apply is Friday, October 1st at midnight. And we are going to have an information session on Zoom next week, Tuesday the 21st at 6 p.m. So we'll give people a chance to ask questions. You know, if they're working on applications and have a couple of questions, like, please, we encourage people to join. All the information will be there. Also, you know, you can follow us on Instagram and Facebook, where we post a lot of updates and things like that.
So for more information, once again, go to www.youthfx.org/arts-to-work, and that's the number 2.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Mark Dunley, and our engineer is the intrepid Sina Basila Hickey.
So tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear the local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. You can find all the stories from today's program on our website through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. So until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.